Welcome to the SMA edition of Rare Disease Advisors' Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the spinal muscular atrophy community.
This is Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. We're talking today with Dr. Adrian Craner, a professor and researcher at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory on Long Island, New York. He's also Deputy Director of Research at the Cold Spring Harbor Cancer Center. A native of Uruguay and a child of Jewish Holocaust survivors, Dr. Craner came to the United States in 1977. He studied biochemistry at Columbia University, then did his PhD at Harvard. He came to Cold Spring Harbor Lab in 1989, where he's been ever since. Thank you so much for making time to talk with us today.
My pleasure, Larry.
Let's start by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you came to specialize in rare diseases.
So my research has both basic and applied aspects. And in terms of the basic aspects, I'm interested in RNA and RNA splicing in particular. That's a topic I've been studying since I was a graduate student. And then over the course of this research, I came to realize, you know, how important splicing can be in the context of genetic disorders and cancer. And the first rare disease that I started working substantially on is spinal muscular atrophy, because I came across results that were published in 1999 that indicated that splicing was an important aspect of this disease. And so ever since, we have, part of the laboratory has focused on spinal muscular atrophy.
What's interesting about spinal muscular atrophy is that among so many rare diseases, it's one of the few where therapies are actually now available. Three therapies have been approved, including gene therapy. Can you talk about what makes SMA unique?
From my point of view, there is an underlying splicing defect in one of two genes that are important for this disease. And so all the patients with SMA have this gene that one can target either to replace it in the case of gene therapy or to correct the way in which its RNA undergoes splicing, which is what our research focused on. So normally we have been working on other genetic diseases, rare diseases, but typically you have, in the case of splicing, you have some mutations that cause defective splicing, but there's usually very few patients who have those particular mutations. In SMA, all the patients have the SMN2 gene with an underlying splicing defect. And so if you develop one therapy for one patient, it can be used for all SMA patients in principle.
Before Spinraza came along, and we'll talk about that in a bit, what was there for people with SMA?
Basically, no real treatment. So people could deal with the problems, the symptoms, just trying to alleviate the suffering. For instance, difficulty breathing, so you could use ventilators, some physical therapy, but basically there was very little that could be done. And so there was the need for therapy was very acute.
And could you talk a bit about the work you did specifically that led to the FDA's approval of nusinersen, known as Spinraza?
We started working on SMA in 2000. Basically, what was described in 1999 was a difference in the way the transcripts from SMN1 and SMN2 genes are spliced. That was clearly in the area that we were already studying in the context of other genes. And so there's a tendency to skip one of the exons, exon 7, in the RNA from SMN2. And SMA patients don't have a functional SMN1 gene, so they depend on SMN2. But because of the splicing nature of SMN2, it makes only a small amount of functional protein. So for the first couple of years, we studied what is the difference between SMN1 and SMN2, given that there are very few nucleotide differences between them. What's the basis for the difference in splicing? And so that was very basic work. It gave us some understanding and led us to start thinking about what can we do now to increase exon 7 inclusion in SMN2 RNA. So we started doing that in the early 2000s, and then we started very seriously screening for antisense oligonucleotides to do that in 2004, when we started a collaboration with Ionis Pharmaceuticals.
And then that eventually led to the FDA approval of nusinersen in 2016.
Correct.
How did you get from there to FDA approval?
you know, it's a very stepwise process. You know, first, we had some basic understanding of the mechanisms that we're trying to perturb. We started exploring how to do that with antisense oligonucleotides. We started screening for antisense oligos in 2004, as I mentioned. By 2008, we published the sequence of nusinersen, and we showed its effectiveness in a mouse model. At least we showed target engagement. And so that was a whole process. We worked in cell-free systems. We worked in cell lines, patient-derived fibroblasts, and then mouse models of SMA as they were becoming available. And so that's what we consider the preclinical development. So it's about 8 years of work, but we continued then to increase effectiveness and to understand the mechanism of action or how we could deliver this in the mouse models. But by 2011, November, that's when the phase one clinical trial started. So we did preclinical work here, and Ionis Pharmaceuticals, based on the results in mice, did extensive toxicity studies in rodents and in non-human primates, just to kind of pave the way for the FDA authorizing clinical trials. And so those start in November of 2011 and all the way up to approval, which was in December 23rd, 2016.
The Muscular Dystrophy Association has been supporting your work, correct?
Yeah, so they did for a period of time, a very crucial period of time, when we had developed nusinersen, the antisense oligonucleotides, based on work in cell culture. We needed to now move to animal models. And at that point, we had funding from the NIH, but to undertake these new studies, that's when the NDA gave us support and to support the collaboration with Ionis. So very grateful for that, because the mouse studies were really critical to show that this idea would work in vivo. And the results were very striking in mice. You know, we could extend the survival of mice with a very severe type 1-like SMA, and the mice weren't just surviving, they were running around fairly normally. And we learned how to deliver the oligo to the motor neurons. And so it was very important preclinical stage of the work to then justify the clinical development.
Dr. Kenner, were you surprised at the success of Spinraza as it stands today in patients with SMA?
I have to say yes. I mean, there are some incredibly striking results. Most strikingly is that if you treat very young patients who have the genetic diagnosis, but before the onset of symptoms, you can basically prevent the onset of the disease. So far, that's been the case for up to 5 years, and we hope it'll be the case forever. So that's, what more can you ask for? And then even in patients that already have disease from, they've lived with SMA for a few years, but in some cases for decades, one can see impact of the drug. Clearly, the effectiveness is greater if you intervene sooner. That's not surprising for a degenerative disease. And I have to say that, you know, before the clinical studies, we weren't quite sure what we could expect. You know, there were pessimistic scenarios that argued that, well, you know, maybe everything that's important that requires the SMN, normal levels of SMN protein happens during development, and what can you do about that? And so that's a pessimistic scenario. The optimistic scenario is, you know, people will start walking straight out of their wheelchairs, and nobody really expected that. Realistically, one could have said, well, maybe we'll just stabilize the disease and keep it from progressing further. But I think the results are better than that. You can prevent the onset if you start early enough. And even if the disease has already run part of its course, the intervention can result in people improving over time. And so that's really quite remarkable.
But in order to get the most optimal results, as you said, you have to start treating very early. And I'm guessing that is contingent upon newborn screening.
Yeah. Yeah. Newborn screening is really essential for that. And so the cases, the striking cases that I've seen are patients who start treatment at, let's say, 9 or 10 days of age following genetic diagnosis. And the early cases, early examples of that were because these were families that had already had a child or more than one child with type 1 SMA, for example. And so when they had a newborn, they got rapidly screened. But that's not what would happen normally. So you need newborn screening to include SMA and the standard routine newborn screening. At the moment, last time I checked, 38 states in the U.S. are doing that already. And I think it's extremely important, because then you can catch these cases when the intervention can be done right away, and that's when it helps the most.
Yes, in fact, we just had a story on SMA, efforts to enact nationwide screening for SMA. I wanted to ask you about Zolgensma and Risdiplam, which are also now, of course, FDA approved to treat spinal muscular atrophy. Risdiplam being an oral therapy and Zolgensma being a one-time gene therapy. How would you compare the efficacy of these other drugs with Spinraza?
Yeah, I don't think anybody has a sound basis to compare efficacy because you would have to do head-to-head comparisons in a clinical trial, and I'm not aware of those being done. But I believe that there are patients who, for one reason or another, have taken two or more of the treatments. There are some clinical trials underway in which patients are going to switch from one treatment to another. And then there's anecdotal evidence. So I think it's hard to say. All three therapies aim to increase the levels of SMN protein, which is it's the basis of the disorder, that the SMN levels are lower than they should be. And so, you know, I think all treatments are shown to be disease modifying. And I think it's hard to say. I mean, the methods of administration or frequency are very different. And so then it comes down at the moment to preferences by patients or what the physicians recommend. I'm not sure that there's a very objective basis to say you should be on this therapy, but not that therapy. And so eventually there will be more information to make a determination.
Well, there's also a cost factor here too. As you well know, Spinraza over time can cost millions and millions of dollars as opposed to a one-time gene therapy. The question that I have is, how do we know that it's a one-time therapy?
Well, we don't know, right? So you have to wait and see. And so there are patients who received Zolgensma and now are entering a study sponsored by Biogen to receive Spinraza. So I don't know if they can get a further benefit.
Can you combine the two?
In principle, yes. But of course, I think all three therapies are extremely expensive from my point of view. And so that comes down to who pays or who reimburses for that. And some of the patients who have taken two therapies, the reason is that they were in a clinical trial for one of them and the other one, it may be covered by insurance. And so maybe based on that experience, one may know how to progress. But the principle of gene therapy is that you may only need it once. But if you think it's going to last for 30 years, you have to wait 30 years to make sure. And so it's hard to say.
Do you think you can transfer the knowledge that you have gained from your work with SMA to other rare diseases? And I'm thinking, for example, of Duchenne muscular dystrophy and perhaps Pompe disease?
Yeah, I think so. For instance, antisense technology certainly can be utilized in other diseases, and we're working actively in that area, and so are others in academia and in biotech pharma. There are, in fact, antisense therapies for Duchenne. They're very specific to particular lesions in the dystrophin gene. There's a bit controversy about how efficacious they are. And I think part of the reason for that is that the target is the muscle. And, you know, there's a lot of muscle in the body. And so you need a lot of oligo and you need efficient uptake. Probably there's room for improvement there. And so that's different from Spinraza, which is delivered to the cerebrospinal fluid. And so you have these kinds of differences. And Spinraza targets splicing. And so for a number of diseases, you can modify splicing for a therapeutic purpose, but maybe not for all diseases, or it depends on the type of mutation that gives rise to the genetic disease. As I alluded to before, I mean, there are diseases where there are many, many different mutations, and so you might be able to use Spinraza-like approaches for some of the mutations, but not all. In other cases, maybe you can. So yeah, we are working on a number of diseases based on this. But I have to say that, you know, SMA was a special case because you have thousands of patients all with the same lesion that's inherent in the gene that we're targeting.
This is very interesting. I'm sure we could go on for hours talking about this. Thank you very much, Dr. Craner, for your time. And this is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.